case of Huber versus Entrada. You may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is John R. Olson, 9475. This case comes before the court now for a second time because of a monetary sanction of me in a trial in Boulder District Court and post-trial proceedings upon remand from this court. In this case, an employee was terminated for a comparatively trivial misstep. Our theory before the court was he was terminated, in fact, for reporting more serious violations of the rules of the company, including use of alcohol and intoxication in the computer room that operated the nation's 911 emergency system. We lost the trial in that case, the trial to court. In that trial, the trial judge forbade us to introduce any evidence that other people, other employees in the same department with the same supervisory chain of command, the same computer equipment, had committed far worse violations of company procedures and policies known to management and never been punished for it.
Mr. Olson, yes, you premise your argument that the violation that Mr. Huber was ostensibly fired for was a minor one. What in the record indicates that it's a minor infraction?
Well, the record established that there had been, he was terminated for failing to report to Microsoft Corporation a glitch in the computer system. That had happened many times before. He had been told to simply go correct it, which he did in this instance as well. And so based upon that, circumstantially, it was a relatively minor offense. However, Your Honor, even if it had been a serious offense, it would still be relevant to show that other employees committed equally serious offenses and were never so much as reprimanded for it, let alone terminated for it. So the seriousness of what Mr. Huber did may not be perfectly relevant to what I hope the court's ultimate decision should be. The trial court sanctioned me upon a ruling and then a re-ruling later. Well, I take that back. Initially, the trial court did not give any reason for sanctioning me. And that came up before this court, and this court found she had not articulated or written any reason for that and remanded it for her to do so. Upon remand, she entertained our oral argument. She reviewed the submissions. And she then ruled again for the first time, quote, and there has still been no articulation by plaintiff's counsel as to how that evidence would be relevant to the promissory estoppel claim, meaning the bad act evidence of other employees who were not punished.
What is the answer to that question?
The answer to that question is we presented the relevance of it in our written submission and our oral submissions two times, pointing out the case law that this court has established, as well as the Tenth Circuit Court, that other bad acts are perfectly admissible and relevant.
They certainly are in the context of discrimination cases.
And retaliation cases.
But if the sole claim remaining in the case is one of promissory estoppel, how does that support the admission of evidence that relates to, I guess, not even what's claimed to be the pretext, but instead simply a theory that other people didn't get fired for doing things that were worse? How
Your
does
Honor,
that relate to the narrow elements of promissory estoppel?
Your Honor, the narrow elements of promissory estoppel do not forbid showing the motivation for what happened to our client. And so because it's a promissory estoppel case, has nothing to do with ultimately being permitted to prove the truth of the matter, which is that he was terminated for a pretextual reason. This is a retaliation case in the classic sense. We have the opportunity to show that the reasons given for terminating him are not the true reasons. It doesn't matter whether it's characterized as discrimination, federal retaliation, state contract breach, or estoppel. We still have the right and the opportunity to show the trier fact. These weren't the true reasons. This was a pretext. This was retaliation against him. And he had been promised repeatedly no retaliation for reporting wrongdoing.
What are the
Why would you have the right to show the trier of fact what the true motivation was if it does not relate to any of the elements of promissory estoppel?
Well, we still have to show the trier of fact, as a matter of fact, that he was terminated for breaches of the very promises made to him of no retaliation.
Well, couldn't you show that by somehow showing that he was terminated for some reason other than what the employer said he was terminated for?
Yes, Your Honor, we could, and we could always do that in any case, but to make it more likely than not that an improper reason was selected, we sought to deduce evidence that other people were never punished for far more serious offenses. And that, as this court has found, is always relevant, and they don't even have to be of comparable seriousness, and they don't have to be identical offenses in the case law that we have cited from this court and from the Tenth Circuit.
One of the bases, as I understand it, of the trial court's ruling was that there was no evidentiary support for allegations concerning the eavesdropping of phone conversations and use at parties and the like.
First, Your Honor, that's not true. I was sanctioned for filing a written opposition to motion in limine, and in that response, we responded with our presentation of the facts and the law. In oral argument, Your Honor, we presented in specific answers to the judge's questions what evidence we would be presenting, what it would be about, and why it was relevant. And we specifically said we were not adducing evidence relating to parties. So what has happened is the court, Your Honor, has done what the trial court did. It jumped to this party issue. And in the trial court's case, it didn't hear me when I said, we are not adducing evidence of, Your Honor, parties. And that's not referred to in any of our written responses to their motion in limine. So what happened is the trial court morphed this into something that somehow made the trial judge angry and didn't hear me point blank say, which the court is able to read in the transcript, no, Your Honor, we are not adducing evidence of parties, but we are adducing evidence of illegal wiretapping and use of these tapes to listen to conversations of wives and other people that were private in nature and for which they were never punished.
Mr. Olson, if you would, carry us through the inferences that would be drawn from their failures to take action, disciplinary action, against other employees for, I don't know if they were different or the same kind of conduct. How does that get us to, in this case, the conclusion that their stated reason was not the true reason for the separation, for the firing?
Well, in this case, Mr. Huber reported alcohol abuse inside the computer room, and he then eventually was terminated by the very boss who got into trouble because of that alcohol abuse. The company then selected a reason, including that boss, selected a reason to terminate him that was comparatively trivial in nature to these other offenses. Logically, that demonstrates that the reason selected could not have possibly risen to the level of a fireable offense. This company didn't even consider for this long-term employee a oral reprimand, a discipline letter, a suspension. It just fired him outright. It was clearly an act of retaliation for his having gotten his boss into trouble. Now, if that were not so,
What was the evidence you wanted to introduce that you were not permitted to introduce?
What is the evidence that we sought to introduce? Evidence that the employees of Intrado in that department with the computers had eavesdropped. They had the capability of eavesdropping on any conversation in the United States.
They had the capability.
They did. They did do that. They did it for fun. That was the proof we were trying to produce through real witnesses who were present when it happened.
Okay, employees did eavesdropped on conversations of citizens around the United States?
Yes, and then took certain ones that seemed humorous to them and played them back for their fellow employees.
And how were you going to introduce that evidence?
Through live witnesses, Your Honor.
And who were those witnesses?
Your Honor, I would like to, I'd be happy to disclose those witnesses in camera, but at this point, we disclose all of our witnesses to the trial court. They're all on the record, and we now fear that this company wants to pursue those people.
So you disclosed to the trial court witnesses who would testify that employees were listening in on conversations of American citizens?
Absolutely, including the plaintiff himself, Your Honor.
All right, and so...
Mr. Huber.
So then what's the inference to be drawn from that?
The inference is that they selected a bogus or false reason, a pretextual reason to terminate him.
So,
because what
so
he did was...
The interim step would have to be that this was brought to the attention
of management. That's
of
correct.
Of management.
Yes.
And management took no disciplinary action with regard to it.
The same chain of command knew of this and never did a thing about it. Your Honor, this case also goes to an additional step of whether our presentation of this argument on the facts and the law, and whether our efforts to specifically and honestly answer the court's specific questions goes to frivolous practice in this state. Any lawyer who did not seek to introduce this evidence that other people were not disciplined for far more serious offenses under the case law that this court has established would be culpable for malpractice. But yet this court initially sanctioned me without even saying why. This court remanded.
Mr. Olson, if I recall the record correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, that, and in fact you quoted in your briefs, the court was asking you if you had any evidence of tape-recorded conversations being played for entertainment purposes.
It said parties. The court said parties.
At parties.
Yes.
And your response to that was no.
That's correct.
But you did have evidence that they had tape-recorded messages?
That they had listened to tape recordings of messages, that's correct.
And that they had done...
Or discussions.
They had listened to those.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And they had listened to those in the office?
At the company offices, that is correct, Your Honor.
And you responded to the court that you had that evidence, just not at parties?
Yes, and the court ruled we couldn't use it. The court then went on to rule later after your remand that I had never articulated the relevance of this evidence. We had done so three different times in writing and orally, citing the cases, citing the actual facts, and the court went on to say we still haven't articulated a reason. I understand the court may be thinking that somehow the issue of this claim being promissory estoppel might change the way evidence would be produced under the Colorado Rules of Evidence. And might change somehow the ultimate issue, but it doesn't. The ultimate issue was that they selected a pretextual reason to fire him, whether it's promissory estoppel or contract or discrimination.
That's my question. Let's assume that there was a pretextual reason for terminating Mr. Huber. Where does that fit in to the elements of a promissory estoppel claim? Where is that relevant?
To his detriment, the fourth element. He relied upon the promises of no retaliation by reporting alcohol abuse in the computer room. He was punished for it by being terminated. It goes to the proof that he was punished for it, that he suffered a detriment. It goes to our proof that that's the real reason that this company got even with him. May I save, if I have any time left, a little bit of time?
You have about a minute and a half, you may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Dan Satriana, registration number 9945 of Clisham, Satriana, and Biskin on behalf of Intrado. Your Honors, this is an important case, and the reason that it is an important case is because if the statute regarding frivolous and groundless claims and positions is to have any teeth at all, when attorneys make arguments that lack substantial justification, they must be sanctioned by the trial court. Here, it is we believe on the record, absolutely clear that Mr. Huber's counsel's arguments regarding an opposition to Entrado's motion in limine had not one scintilla of either factual or legal basis. And as the court's pointed out in the questions that it's asked Mr. Olson, the only claim before the trial court for trial was a claim of promissory estoppel. And therefore, the elements of that claim and the essential issue before the trial court was, did Entrado make a promise to Mr. Huber that he would not be terminated for reporting instances of alcohol possession and use in the workplace? And did Entrado not follow through on that promise? And the trial court, after hearing all the evidence, found in Entrado's favor that there was no evidence that, or at least not compelling evidence that persuaded the court, that the plaintiff had proved that he was terminated because he reported alcohol possession or use in the workplace.
Well, I mean, that's after, you said after hearing all the evidence, but not hearing the evidence that Mr. Olson wanted to present. I mean, without that evidence, the court reached that conclusion.
Well, as to, Judge Carparelli, as to the issue of the motion in limine, there are, I think, two things that are absolutely, again, absolutely clear on the record. At no time, and I have now counted, I believe it's either 8 or 9 different instances that Mr. Olson had the opportunity and was in fact encouraged by the trial court to provide information regarding the factual support for the two issues that were framed by Entrado's motion in limine, and those were that employees of Entrado took tape-recorded conversations off work premises and played them at parties. That was the initial allegation that Mr. Huber made. These things came up because of allegations that Mr. Huber made when I took his deposition. The other issue was...
Were those allegations indicated in any trial management order, or was there any other indication that Mr. Huber specifically intended to introduce that evidence at trial?
None at all, but out of an abundance of caution, because we had heard those allegations made by Mr. Huber in his deposition, we wanted to make sure that these, what we believed and what the trial court agreed, were irrelevant to the promissory estoppel claim, did not come in at trial, so that we were off subject.
So is the point that even if he had evidence, it was irrelevant, or is the point that it might have been relevant, but he had no evidence?
Your Honor, our contention is both. There was no evidence of any of these contentions. These contentions to this day, before this court right now, are mere contentions.
What about Mr. Olson's claim that there was information about witnesses, other employees of Entrado, who would testify about this capability, and not only capability, but actual eavesdropping occurring on other employees' telephone conversations? The way I understood that statement was that those were given to the trial court in camera, or?
Not at all, Your Honor. Judge Hawthorne, Mr. Olson has never, ever provided the name of one witness or the existence of one document that in any way supports either of these allegations that was the focus of our motion in limine. Never. Not at the trial court level, not in disclosures, not in the trial management order, not in the response to our motion, the written response to our motion in limine, not in the oral argument that took place prior to the beginning of trial. Not one time. And continuing afterwards, Mr. Olson has never made any offer of proof as to any individual or any document that would support these contentions. These are just bald, unsupported contentions that continue to this day. So, Judge Carparelli, that's why I say, in the first instance,
well,
and the trial court...
Let me interrupt you for a minute. You said that this came to your attention at Mr. Huber's deposition.
Yes.
Why isn't Mr. Huber's testimony evidence that such things were going on? Why couldn't he testify?
Because Mr. Huber did not state that he had any firsthand knowledge of any of this. So Mr. Olson had to bring in relevant, admissible evidence of these contentions, which he never did. And in fact, if Mr. Huber, in some respect, had some firsthand knowledge, Mr. Olson never argued that to the trial court at all. And Your Honor, this is a very frustrating issue for Entrato, because this has been, if you will, with all due respect to Mr. Olson, a moving target throughout this case. He has never provided any information that would support these contentions. He then, in this appeal, for the first time, urges this court to find that he was not allowed to provide this evidence, that the court intimidated him, that it interrupted him. We believe that just a reading of the transcript in this case belies any contention that he was prohibited from doing so. And clearly, before there was even oral argument the first morning of trial, Mr. Olson had the opportunity to lay out that evidence in writing in his response to our motion in limine.
Let me ask you about that. The distinction is drawn by him between what's contained in his actual response to the motion in limine and what occurred at the hearing and the responses to the judge's questions. If you do look at his response to the motion in limine, it's sort of general and simply says we're entitled to put on evidence that there were worse things going on for which people weren't being sanctioned. Therefore, this goes to establish that this was really a pretextual basis for my termination. It's a pretty bland response as compared to what went on at the oral argument. Is he being sanctioned for what he said at the oral argument or for what was in the written motion?
Your Honor, I believe, Judge Kopelke, he's being sanctioned because he made an argument, both in writing and orally, that lacked substantial justification, that in response to the issue of do you have any information on these two bases that were the subject of the motion in limine, and why is it relevant, he provided no information to support it, so there was no factual basis at all. And in a moment I'll come to this, that even if he had, which he didn't, some factual basis for it, there was no relevance whatsoever. And as the trial court found again on remand at the March 19, 2008 hearing, not only did he not present any facts, he never articulated any basis that this information, if he had it, which he didn't, that it would be relevant to the promissory estoppel claim. I'm probably repeating some questions that the panel asked Mr. Olson, but again, this is not a discrimination claim. It never was. It is not a retaliation claim. It is a promissory estoppel claim. And again, the issue is, did Entrato make a promise that it would not terminate Mr. Huber for reporting alcohol possession or use in the workplace? And did it breach that promise if it made it? That does not involve any issue of any sort of other conduct whatsoever, because again, it is a promissory estoppel case. It is not an employment discrimination case.
Are you saying that he couldn't have put on evidence, for example, that would suggest that the basis for his termination was blowing the whistle on a superior on the alcohol incident?
Well,
then
no.
That would be relevant, would it not, to the promissory estoppel?
Absolutely, okay. Your Honor. And he presented that evidence. He attempted to present that evidence. It was not persuasive to the trial court, but he was not prevented from doing that. The issue is, are these other contentions of other issues that have nothing to do with alcohol possession or use, have nothing to do with, and there's been no allegation. Today is the first time that Mr. Olson has stated that in some way these issues that were the subject of the motion in limine had anything to do with Mr. Huber's immediate supervisor or anybody in the supervisory chain. Because as this court knows, not only under federal law, but this court's decision in the St. Croix case, the only time that these similarly situated issues are relevant is, first of all, in an employment discrimination case, either under the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act or under Title VII, and it has to relate to a person that is similarly situated to the plaintiff.
Mr. Satriani, I mean, I understand that it is admissible in those cases, but the mere fact that this is not one of those cases doesn't mean it's not admissible here. I mean, you seem to be saying that in order for it to be admissible, this must be a Title VII case. And I, my reaction to that is that it frankly doesn't follow. Here you've got a situation in which Entrato is saying, we fired him for reason X. And Mr. Huber's trying to challenge that. And he's saying, no, that's not your reason. And I can prove that that's not your reason because many other people have committed lesser violations than what I did, and they did not get fired. So why are you firing me? I mean, I think it's attacking Entrato's credibility. It's not necessarily saying, yes, I was terminated for the purpose of because I reported. What it's saying is, no, I wasn't terminated for the reason you say, because if that were the case, everybody around here would have got fired a long time ago. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, here, I think there's a number of things that are wrong with that argument. First of all, at trial and throughout the course of this case, Mr. Olson contended that Mr. Huber was terminated because he reported alcohol violations. So again, framed by the claim in the case, the issue is, was he promised he wouldn't, and was he in fact terminated? With all due respect, I don't believe that has anything to do with whether other employees committed other violations and engaged in tape recording conversations or eavesdropping.
Let me ask you the question this way. Why could he not, given sufficient evidence, cross-examine Entrada's executive and saying, that was not your reason at all, was it? And of course he would say, of course it was my reason. And he'd say, well, these other people committed this violation and this violation, and those were worse than my violation. In fact, they committed them two and three times.
Well, if...
Isn't that impeachment of the person's testimony as to his motivation?
Okay. If certain... I would agree with you if certain evidentiary bases had been satisfied. And that gets us back to the St. Croix case and the line of cases by this court and federal cases that talk about similarly situated employees. And when we look at St. Croix, we see that what this court said was that in order for that to be relevant and admissible in a discrimination case, you have to show that the employee was the comparator or the similarly situated employee was someone who is in the same department under the same supervision of the same supervisor. There was never any predicate laid for any of that evidence, either in response to the motion in limine or at trial, that anything having to do with employees that were also supervised by Mr. Huber's supervisor had engaged in this recording of or use of telephone conversations or eavesdropping on other phone calls. Not one scintilla. So assuming for the sake of argument that that kind of a line of questioning would be relevant, there was no predicate laid, even under St. Croix, if we say St. Croix also applies to promissory estoppel cases, which Entrato contends it doesn't. But if we say, yes, it does, those predicates were not laid, and therefore we're back to not only are there no facts to support it, but there was never any offer that said, I am going to show evidence that employee X, who was also supervised by Jim West, who was Mr. Huber's supervisor, engaged in this behavior, and Mr. West knew about it, and he went forward and didn't terminate this employee because he engaged in that behavior. So again, we're back to absolutely no facts that support it and no showing of relevancy in this case.
There's one unusual aspect of this issue as I see it, and that is it begins with your motion, not his. It's a motion in limine.
Yes.
Is it your position that the only thing he could do without putting himself at risk for a sanction was to confess the motion?
Yeah, I see that I'm out of time, but if I can respond to that question. Yes, because he never brought forward any evidence that would have shown that there was a good faith justification for opposing the motion in the first instance. If he had brought information and said, here are the people that are going to come in and testify, here are the documents that I have, and I can show that this happened, and here's why it's relevant, then perhaps we would have a different situation. But given what's happened here, repeatedly, not only at the trial court level, but also repeatedly thereafter, there's never been any proffer of any evidence that supported.
He does, in the written response, not go into any of the individual evidence. He simply says, in the big picture, this would be relevant to show that it's more likely pretextual. As a result, he's getting sanctioned. There's a little bit of a concern that I have that lawyers who were to be zealous advocates are at risk, as in here, simply for filing something to say that we think it's relevant. It turned out to be wrong, and I think that's a correct decision, but it's a sanction. It's significant.
May I respond? I know I'm out of time. Yeah. May I respond?
And I'm sorry that takes so much time. But
no, that's okay.
If you could just give me a...
Again, there is no legal basis that Mr. Olson has articulated for why it would be relevant to the claim that was before the court. I don't think that a lawyer discharges or in some way avoids sanctions under the frivolous and groundless statute by saying, I think it's relevant. I think that you have to articulate a factual and legal basis as to why it's relevant. And the trial court repeatedly tried to find out from Mr. Olson, what's the relevance? Have you, if you're going to say that it's some other act, why, what's the articulable basis under Colorado law as to why that's the case? And he never did it. So it's not merely saying, I think it's relevant and I'm making an argument and therefore it's chilling me because I'm being sanctioned. It's because he had the opportunity on multiple occasions to articulate that factual and legal basis and to this day has never done so.
Mr. Satriana, I'd like to understand that. It seems to me from the record that he articulated something that he viewed as a basis for upon which he was going to try to admit the evidence. So he was making his relevance argument. You believe that the relevance argument loses by a long shot. The court agrees that it doesn't accept his relevance argument. How is this any difference from a run-of-the-mill situation where somebody says, Your Honor, this is the relevance, and everybody says, I sure don't see it, you lose? Why can't lawyers get sanctioned every day for making arguments that are other people don't find persuasive?
Because in this case, Judge Carparelli, Mr. Olson never articulated any facts or has not cited a case to this court that supports his claim that it's relevant. So it's not merely you lose so you run the risk of being sanctioned. It's no witnesses identified, no documents identified, no decision that would indicate that it would be relevant to this particular case on promissory estoppel. And therefore, it's because under the statute and the Supreme Court's pronouncement as to what is frivolous, groundless, or vexatious behavior, not having a factual basis and not having a legal basis satisfies the test that the Supreme Court set out in Western Realty for why it is frivolous and groundless. It's not merely losing the argument, it's not having anything at all to back it up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What do you say to that, Mr. Olson?
Yes. A couple, minute and 36. Mr. Satriana has once again morphed this case and this issue into something that never existed. He did it on his own. He bootstrapped this out of a deposition he took, not I took. He took, where he, not I, elicited testimony from my client that this company, he was asked, why, Mr. Huber, do you think this is wrong, what happened to you? Why do you think you shouldn't have been punished? And Mr. Huber spoke and said, employees in my department in this operation working with the same computers have repeatedly listened to these 911 tapes for fun and games, and nothing was done to them about it, and yet they picked this trivial reason to terminate me. Mr. Satriana brought that up. So then Mr. Satriana filed a motion in limine based upon legalistic argument that other bad acts were not relevant. And I responded to that appropriately, zealously, under the case law, that other bad act evidence is relevant. And we haven't even gotten to Rule 404 yet to show other evidence, regardless of whether it's a promissory estoppel case or a discrimination case or terminating somebody for filing a workers' comp claim or terminating somebody for going to jury duty or being in the service for 6 months. Those things are illegal in Colorado, or for terminating somebody in breach of a contract. 404 evidence remains relevant no matter what the cause of action is. Furthermore, Mr. Satriana has once again stated the trial court lifted his argument out of his brief to say that I never articulated the relevance. I did it 4 or 5 times in writing and orally. I cited the case law, and the case law is very clear. Contrary to what Mr. Satriana says, employees do not have to be absolutely identical. They have to be in comparable situations, and even the offenses do not have to be of comparable seriousness under the law that you have established in Colorado. This, we never got a chance to present this evidence. Mr. Satriano keeps saying, well, all throughout the whole trial, we didn't present that evidence. If we had, we'd have been sanctioned for disobeying a court's order that excluded all that evidence. Thank you very much.
But let me ask you this. I agree. You may have been sanctioned for introducing that evidence after the court entered its order, limiting it. However, what prevented you from introducing that evidence in response to the defendant's motion in limine?
As a
response, and say, here's what I have. Here's the evidence that I'm going to present.
Mr. Satriana never challenged that we didn't have that evidence. He knew that evidence existed from his own deposition of our client. He claims, well, that evidence was inadmissible. Not so. Any observation inside that company, including a hearsay observation from management who sat in on those very meetings or who mentioned that they were aware that this illegal eavesdropping had occurred, would be classically admissible. But we never had a chance to prove that. Then, in the oral questioning of the court by me, I answered every question the court asked. The court never said, name me your witnesses, or we would have done so easily. We would have said so. But the court never asked me that. But I was not sanctioned for what we said orally in court. I was sanctioned for our written response to motion in limine. That rule, at least the opportunity to not be sanctioned for trying to adduce other bad act evidence in a discrimination case, an employment case, a retaliation case, is so critical to employment law in Colorado. If this court upholds that sanction, I dare think that many lawyers will never do that again. They won't try to do that, particularly with this particular trial judge, because you will be stamping what she did, saying that's okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel, and thank you for being so responsive to our